Welcome to History Conspiracy Podcast, where we provide the audio and you decide whether it's history or conspiracy.
The 22nd of December, we're at Potomac Tricon, and we're about to begin an interview with Danielle O'Brien, 9-1-1 Secure, 9-1-1 Commission.
Kevin Schaefer, 9-1-1 Commission.
David Lee, Band FA Council.
Danielle O'Brien Powell.
Thank you for that. Danielle, we have two statements actually you made. One was on American 77 outgoing, and then one was on the unknown target coming back in, which you played a key role in identifying. Have you had a chance to look at your statements?
I have, right after they were prepared. I've not reviewed them for some time.
Would you like to read one?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
So you can just keep that with you if you want, and I'll give you a moment to go ahead and read it, and then I'll chat with you about that and also the transcript. And, you know, typically we start by asking individuals to give us a little bit of a history of the background, how long they've been an air traffic controller, work experience, the positions they've held, and then the position they held at 9/11. So if you could start there, we'd appreciate it.
In 1987, I joined the Pennsylvania Air National Guard as an air traffic controller. I completed my training with them in 1988. I continued on part-time guard status through 1992. In 1990, I was hired by the Federal Aviation Administration as an air traffic control specialist. I attended the Mike Minerney Aeronautical Institute for standard air traffic control training. Completed my training in April of 90. I was then assigned to Washington Air Route Traffic Control Center in Leesburg, Virginia. I was employed there and successfully completed training. In 1993, I transferred to Norfolk Air Traffic Control Tower with radar and control tower responsibility.
Go ahead.
In 1995, I applied for transfer and was transferred to the Guam CRAP, which is Center and Radar Approach Control, on the island of Guam.
Wow.
I had 4 years of employment on Guam, during which I had a year and a half in quality assurance and training. I also spent 6 months as a temporary supervisor. In 1999, after completion of my contract on the overseas portion of my employment, I returned to the Eastern Region and was assigned to Dulles Air Traffic Control Tower. In December of 2002, when the Dulles facility was split, radar and tower, I elected to come to the Potomac Tricon, and I've been employed here since.
And what position, what sector or area, or back up, because I'm confusing the Tricon with the tower, and Dulles Tower, what position were you in that day?
I was at the time of departure, I was working what was then called the North High position. And at the time that we detected the target returning inbound, I was working a combined position of Final West and Final East.
And is it typical that during the course of a day that you would work several different positions?
Yes.
In the tower? That was not unusual?
Correct.
And you were qualified in all the positions that way.
While we're waiting for Kevin, after he returns, I want to go back just over your history. You've got some interesting pieces to your history that are intriguing. You're trained by the military as a air traffic controller.
Correct.
How much additional or more sophisticated training, if at all, did you have to undergo when you became an FAA controller?
The FAA air traffic controller is significantly different than the training that I received. While most Air Force air traffic controllers go to a point that more closely resembles FAA air traffic control, a guardsman's training is limited to the final approach position. So while I completed my training, including basic training, technical school, and on-the-job training with the Guard in only 1 year, it could take a great deal extra time to bring it to the approach control level for a full-time Air Force air traffic controller.
You also said that at one point you worked at Norfolk.
Correct.
And if I could go back, and the amount of time you spent at Norfolk was 1993 until
1995.
So you're 2 years at Norfolk.
Perhaps a little bit more. I don't have the exact dates of my employment. I'm sure that would be included in my personnel file.
And at Norfolk, were you in the tower or in the TRACON side of business there?
It's a co-located facility that you're required to maintain currency and proficiency both in the tower and the TRACON.
So on a typical day at Norfolk, you could have worked the tower or you could have worked the TRACON if you were trained across the board.
Exactly.
And you said your quality assurance and supervisory experience was at Guam. Did you have any of that kind of experience at Norfolk?
No.
While at Norfolk, were you familiar with the procedures and the policies for scrambling alert fighters for landing?
I don't recall.
Did you recall ever participating in an active air scramble or a training scramble off the landing?
We worked the fighters to and from, but I don't recall an actual practice. There may have been. It was very standard operation to work the fighters because they were in and out of an airport that we governed.
Daily,
yes.
There's specific nomenclature that's used at Langley on that whole scramble procedure, practice scrambles, that are simply the getting of military aircraft off the strip at Langley, if you will. Runway at Langley is basically an east-west runway. Are you familiar with that airfield at all?
I no longer recall the configuration of the airfield.
Okay. Did you ever actually go over to Langley?
No.
Let's see. Okay. The hangar, the alert hangar, is at the far western end of the runway. It's a 260-80 configuration, which is almost due east-west. Because the hangar is at the far west end, the fighters typically take off to the east. And they launch out of there for air defense reasons. They can get up to altitude quickly on the water, and they can go straight out. Typically, prior to 911, Langley used what we have learned are called stereo or sterile directions, if you will, to get a fighter's airborne. Are you ever familiar with the terminology or the vectoring of aircraft off the runway at Langley?
Let me think on this one for a minute. It's starting to sound familiar. It's been 10 years since I've considered
Langley
Airspace.
We fully appreciate that, but yeah. we're taking you're a target of opportunity for us, if you will, because you have been in Norfolk, and we're very interested in Norfolk.
And not a target at all, just helping increase our knowledge of the situation.
Target's a bad choice.
Yeah, that sounds very good. Yeah. My recollection now is typically this is a stretch. I recall an issue of direction of landing and departure from Langley in conjunction with the rapid departure of the fighters. We had special use air, and still exists special use airspace off the eastern coastline in that Norfolk area, which is called warning areas. And the fighters would proceed in rapid progression to these warning areas on particular days in planned routes. These were termed as sorties. You've heard that term. And I recall now that they would have to proceed off of the eastern runway because it was an immediate progression. And now that you mentioned that their location on the field, that does make sense. Rapid progression to these warning areas. I don't specifically remember if it makes sense to think that it was a practice scramble. I don't specifically remember it being termed a practice scramble.
Okay.
I don't recall the terminology that they would have used in that situation, but I remember they typically like to land west and depart east. It would make sense. I do not specifically recall them saying this is a practice scramble.
Let's set scramble aside for a moment and just training or just getting the fighters off every day. We've been told that because the fighters proceed so rapidly that as soon as they're headed down the runway, they literally are handed off to Norfolk Tower before they even get airborne. Is that?
That would be accurate. Yes,
accurate.
They would be cleared for departure and instructed to contact departure at the same time.
At the same time. And then they would contact you over you when you were there.
At Norfolk, yes.
Did you work the fighters often in terms of just getting them out and back again?
Yes.
The issue is whether the fighters could come off of Langley and turn immediately to the north. Were there restrictions that you were aware of that precluded them from doing that and continuing out, say, to the warning areas you talked about?
Other than, obviously, other traffic, other non-participating aircraft, I don't recall any specific restrictions that would prohibit their proceeding.
Let me enlist your support on a real puzzle that we have.
What was the time period that you were working at Norfolk?
It was
93, 95.
Yeah. Or 93.
And we appreciate and understand that she's not talking. We're trying to get the feel from someone that was there who knows historically how things work.
Right. So she could speak to, you know, what restrictions there existed during that period of time.
Exactly. And we accept that caveat. But she represents a professional opinion, if you will, that we're actively soliciting here. The fighters were scrambled. The scramble order itself had the fighters going 010 to flight level 290. That's essentially due north, pretty much. The fighters took off and proceeded on runway heading to a certain altitude. And we understand that is normal procedure off any airfield. You take off on runway heading to a certain altitude and then you turn whatever the procedures are. And you have no disagreement with that.
There are standard procedures per airport.
Per airport.
I could not categorize how Langley would currently be operating. Pre-coordinated situations exist really at every airport in the United States that has a control tower. For example, at Dulles, we have set headings that are already established that require no advanced coordination because it's been signed off between a management and a letter of agreement. So what happens at Langley currently on 9/11?
The letter of agreement, and you're exactly right, there are letters of agreement. The letter of agreement established that fighters would take off on runway heading to an altitude 4,000 feet.
I can accept that.
Okay. And that sets them on a course to the east, even though they were scrambled to the north. Then, despite the scramble order, someone entered into the FIDO, and I'm using an acronym, Flight Data Input Output Device, a stereo heading, if you will, or a canned heading of 090 for 60, which literally flies the airplanes, it literally continues them on runway heading for another 60 miles. Does that terminology, do you recall that kind of terminology being used in terms of getting the fighters out to the warning areas?
I'm not sure I'm specifically following you. What terminology?
The terminology from the Langley radio, 090 for 60, is the specific terminology that was used that day.
I don't have a specific recollection of that. It would not be unusual to use pre-established stereo routes to bring the fighters to a designated area, which 60 miles off of Langley should be one of the warning areas.
And we'll put it, I think it's Whiskey 107 or 105, one of those. No, that's incorrect. Those are up north. Just scratch that. Also, during that sequence of events on 911, and clearly we're asking you to go back in history and help us out a little bit, the Northeast Air Defense Sector declared AFIO, Authority for Intercept Operations, and authorized the fighters to squat quad sevens. Does that terminology cause you to recall anything about handling the fighter aircraft when you were at Norfolk?
I've heard the term AFIO, but I don't have a specific recollection of its application to my time at Norfolk.
Okay. Fair enough. Kevin, anything else on Norfolk? That took us way off course from the events of 911, but I had to do that because you have some experience in a location that's key to us. I'd like to come back to your statement now, if we could just sort of proceed down through that. And you start by saying you were working the final west-east position, and I understand that that is a combined position that day.
Correct.
Is it an unusual or unusual a position to be combined?
It's usual in that it frequently happens. It does not constitute a configuration for the whole day. It depends on volume and demand at the time.
And you observed the primary target apart from 10 miles northwest of the Manassas Airport, proceeding southeastbound at a high rate of speed. What are the capabilities of the scope you have in front of you? How far out can you see? How can you detect primaries and so forth? Just walk us through the mechanics of your position, if you will, on that day.
The final west and east position is responsible for the most close-in, most specific airspace, smallest airspace, at what was then the Dulles Tracom. My responsibilities required me to clear aircraft for final approach, monitor the progression to the airport, ensure spacing on the final, to adhere to our requirements. The scope itself can be configured to work any position within the Dulles Tracom. So physically, it is the same as every other scope in the Tracom. Its capabilities for radar is the same as every other scope in the Dulles Tracom. The appropriate airspace to watch is in this position from the ground to 1,000 feet above the highest altitude that I own. I actually, by practice and personal preference, watch 2,500 feet above where I personally own.
And where did you personally own?
5,000 feet. So I was watching 7,500 that day.
Okay. So you went up to 5,000 by procedures, but your personal preference was to watch to 7,500 feet.
And is that a scope setting that you would adjust so that you could see that extra 2,500 feet?
It is a keyboard entry. A
keyboard entry,
yes.
But it's something that you configured when you were sitting at your scope. That's how you configured your scope.
Correct.
Was it possible anybody was watching higher that day?
Yes.
And who would have been watching higher?
The departure controllers own higher airspace. I'll say this. Everyone has an obligation to watch a higher altitude that day. Everyone in Dulles Tracom. Again, I'm the close-in final controller.
Right.
everybody would be working aircraft coming down out of cruising altitudes and being handed off by Washington Center to us for their final transgression into the final.
And what's the altitude dividing line between Washington Center and Dulles?
17,000 feet. 17, is the highest altitude that Dulles could come in.
So scopes could be set to probably even higher than 17, but yes, typically somebody's watching 17 and down. How far out can the scope see in terms of horizontal distance?
Approximately 60 miles.
60 miles. But on a, as a practical matter, are you watching 60 miles?
Definitely not. Practical as a final controller.
As a final controller.
As a final controller, yes.
How far?
You need to be able to monitor only the final, some extra, but the final, which runs typically 25, 30 miles, no more than, in one direction, is what the final controller is responsible to monitor.
Okay. Would somebody have been watching after 60 miles?
Not a 60-mile circumference. It would be 60 miles from Dulles West or Dulles Southwest or Dulles North.
A radius. The radius is 60 miles.
No. Yeah. There is not one controller during that period of the day that will watch the entire space.
Okay. You're watching it in segments.
Correct.
How did this primary target present itself to you? How did you notice that there was something different?
When I first noticed the target, it did not initially strike me as immediate, this is wrong, because planes at that time could come in and out of that area without being radar identified or talking to air traffic control. A hobby pilot who chooses to fly out of Manassas on September 10th that year can go entirely right out of Manassas, fly down over Luray, and you know, really be at their own whim without air traffic control and without any electronic encoding equipment aboard. So, with that in mind, when I first glanced and saw the first return that I noticed of the aircraft, it did not immediately strike me. We get returns on birds. So, flock of geese, plane, you must revisit it as a controller to reconsider, and that's part of your overall scan. You're constantly, your eyes are moving in some type of an arrangement to address each aircraft you're responsible for, as well as things coming to you.
Is it the norm that you would have primaries being displayed?
Yes.
They're never turned off as they are with the high altitude and new controllers on your stage.
I don't recall any situation where we would have turned off primaries.
But primaries are routinely, the ability to see primary colors is routinely on, and, because of the hobby pilots or anybody else that might be out there in the VFR.
Correct.
When did you first realize that it was something different than a typical primary target, if you will?
When I observed the amount of, when I observed what I was using at a high rate of speed.
And you would determine a high rate of speed how?
By the distance between the target.
Between
with
returns.
Each radar return.
And what's the sweep time on the TRACON radar or the tower radar?
I want to say 7 seconds.
7 seconds.
It's very quick.
At that time, what was your situational awareness of what had transpired in New York?
I was familiar with what had transpired in New York. As far as there had been two aircraft that had been what appeared to be intentionally crashed into the tower.
And how did you gain that awareness?
Television on my break.
At what point did you come back off break that morning? Had you been on the scope for some time before you noticed this target coming in, or had you just sat down?
Not a great deal of time. In fact, I think we have my times on position noted here. As 1301 to 1350. I don't recall the exact minute that
But you had been there for a few minutes.
A few minutes, yes.
what was your awareness of the planes or the company that owned them, that hit the World Trade Center north and south? Were you aware there was an American 11 or a United 175?
I don't have a specific recollection of the companies that were involved.
But your awareness was that your position that day that something untoward had happened in New York.
Yeah.
What instructions were given to the controllers in Dulles and by extension Washington Towers that day? What to look for or an awareness different than you might normally have received?
I was made aware that the New York metropolitan area, aircraft landing there or aircraft overflying that area would not be permitted to depart. At a certain point, I was made aware that it was going to what they call ground stop. So, for example, Boston Logan's going through a heavy snowstorm, we will ground stop the Boston planes, prevent them from departing. And based on the situation that had developed in New York City, we were ground stopping those planes in New York and other sites. Then, at another point, they were trying to decide, there was such discussion back and forth, and there was some discussion about the planes that we have in the airspace, let's go ahead and get them on the ground. Then, after the American hit the Pentagon, it was an immediate, the progression was very quick. It was all of them to the ground, regardless of where they had intended to go. We're going to clear everyone to the nearest airport that can support that type of aircraft, with landing requirements and such, just get everybody on the ground.
How about awareness of additional unaccounted for aircraft in the sky? A third airplane out of Boston, for example.
I knew by overhearing discussion that I think the exact words were Washington Center lost a plane. They think that a plane has crashed. But I had no indication to expect to be looking in my airspace for an aircraft returning or coming in unidentified. Air carriers don't, September 10th, air carriers don't turn off their transponders and go flying about the country.
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
So the projection that a plane that had was not in communication and lost its transponder and was simply not visible to anybody that plane had crashed, that would be a natural conclusion, you know. Okay. I'm sorry. American Air 77 specifically, but a plane in general who was out of communication and whose transponder, it's no longer transponding and it cannot be seen on radar. The conclusion that plane is in serious difficulty and has perhaps crashed would be a logical conclusion to draw.
Yes.
So you weren't looking or had no awareness that there might be a target approaching Washington from the west?
Oh, absolutely not.
Now let's take from the north for a moment. At one point in time, it was speculated that there was a third aircraft lost out of Boston, or that the plane that hit the North Tower was not American Air 11. And an American Air 11 itself might be approaching Washington from the north. Have you heard any of that at all?
No.
So you had, at this point in time, as you see this unknown target coming rapidly from the west to the east, had no situational awareness that there might be previous knowledge in the system that a plane was approaching Washington from whatever the direction.
Correct.
Okay. You adjusted the filter limits on the scope so as to display limited data box for altitudes higher than standard to the final control position. No transponder information was displayed for the target. So what are you actually doing when you accomplish these actions?
Instead of watching only the airspace on required plus my additional 2,500 feet, I was watching from surface to 60,000.
And you can do that on your scope very quickly so that you can watch that high and that low.
Correct.
Had anyone directed you to adjust those filter limits, or was that on your own initiative?
On my own initiative.
And to display limited data blocks, what's a limited data block?
An aircraft who is squawking or Hatch 1200, which is the VFR block, we will get the target swap, the 1200 swap, as well as its Node C readout if it has altitude encoding on board.
Was there a data block associated with this target?
No.
Question?
No, not at any time.
Did anyone ever establish a track from the target?
Not that I recall. The aircraft
Okay. Then you say you moved to the west arrival position located immediate to ILF. And does that mean you physically moved to another scope position?
Yes, we have the chairs with wheels and we slide, you know, do you see this, do you see this? You know, we talk amongst ourselves as well as on official lines.
And so, and did you ask that controller? Who was that controller?
My husband.
Your husband at the time?
No.
A gentleman named Howell.
Yes. William Howell.
William Howell. Bill, does he know this? Bill?
Tom.
Tom. Okay.
Middle name.
And so you just scooted over.
Yes.
And met your husband to be.
Literally. We've met before, but joined him.
And you are together watching, and what are you observing and discussing when you do that?
When I slid to the left, I said, you see that fire arrow coming in? How fast he's going. And he too is working planes.
Right.
And he said, yes, oh my gosh. And I said, look how fast he's going. He said, holy cow. And so then I slide back to my right to continue with my assigned duties, my regular, normal, everyday traffic. And that's when I started taking care of the altitude. You know, I'm adjusting my filter limits again. He's monitoring this now. He likewise has 13, 14 years as an FAA controller. And I hold him in very high regard on a professional basis for his opinions as a controller. So it makes total sense for me to ask him as a professional basis about this. And when he concurred with me that this was unusual, it only cemented my concern, and I then felt justified in my concern and need to bring this to the attention of the supervisor, who was truthfully, you know, very into the situation that was happening in New York and very on top of what was going on there, trying to be as assertive as he could and finding out where this was going to take us as a facility in addressing our outbound traffic. So it was then that I felt, you know, it was a good time to notify the supervisor.
And who is your supervisor?
John Hendershaw.
Okay. Was before you and your husband-to-be transmitted or translated awareness, you had others. Were others in the tower aware? You were in the tower, right?
No, I was in the TRACON.
Oh, you were down
the floor below.
Okay, so you had no visual at all. You were down below.
Correct.
Did people in the tower or did other people around you have the same developing awareness that you had?
Not until they heard us discuss.
Did they hear you discussing it?
Mm-hmm. I had a quick question on the scope configuration when you're adjusting the filters. Do you also have an adjustment to adjust the primary track history so it shows that, or are you only seeing, are you plotting that with a grease pencil on your scope itself, or how does that work on the scope that you're using?
The radar display at Dulles is quite a bit different than what's happening here in the TRACON, so if you wander out there to take a look, please don't use it as a accurate representation. The radar scopes at Dulles were a very primitive radar that only showed really a shadow. If you're standing and the sun is here, here's the shadow. It's really that indistinct. Mm-hmm. What I understand that the center has now, which they did not have when I was there, very significant digitized flashes,
mm-hmm.
which or dots, which show a better indication of the speed of the aircraft. At Dulles, we have the shadow. And then a strong hit another storm hit and another.
Okay. And that wasn't anything that you had to adjust. That was tracking along
as
the way it was. And then as far as when you first detected that primary, was that entirely in Dulles' airspace, or was that at all out? Do you have an overlap there? I'm not familiar with the chart layout with how ZVC's airspace overlaps with Dulles. Was that in your own airspace, or did you actually see it when it was in someone else's airspace?
The aircraft was in someone else's airspace.
And that was ZVC's airspace at the time, or it was in someone else?
Unfortunately, not knowing the altitude at the time, I cannot categorically analyze that.
Right.
If it were in the low altitude stratum, it would have been in Dulles Trahan's airspace.
Mm-hmm.
If it were in the high altitude stratum, then it would have been Washington Center's airspace. They own the airspace above 180, 18,000 and above over the Dulles area.
Okay. Thank you.
Two bits of data we have in front of us for the next thing that happens. One is your statement that you tried to contact Washington's National Radar Controllers via the 62 line. And then the transcript itself actually shows from the final west position, National 62, anybody quickly please. TMC says Dulles are primary only. Would that be Hendershot? Who is the TMC position?
TMC would have been Mark Messiah.
Mark, how do you spell his last name?
MASAITIS.
And the TMC is
Traffic Management Coordinator.
And he would report to John. John would be between him and, John was the supervisor.
Correct.
Okay. And then Final West, that's you, National. You've got a primary target headed for P-56 to the west, 10 west, fast moving. To the west, 10 west, 10 means miles.
Yeah.
And fast moving heading your direction. What's the 62 line?
It is an immediate voice line, which by pressing it, the controller at Dulles can be immediately heard in the radar room at Washington National, and likewise on the reverse. So Washington National can immediately be in the speakers in the Tracon at Dulles.
And that 62 line is common to all terminals. Anyone can punch the 62 line, or is that unique to your position?
It's a dedicated line between Dulles and Washington National,
Unique to any one position.
No.
So. And any other person at a scope, seeing what you've seen, they could have also hit the 62 line. And that immediately makes information commonly shared by Dulles and National Towers.
Right.
Anybody else that would listen in on the 62 line?
Just our towers.
Just your towers.
But if the controller beside me and I are both on the 62 line at the same time, we can hear each other as well as another facility. So it's like a party line.
How does ZDC get tied in at all? How do they gain awareness?
We have dedicated lines for them.
That's a different line?
Yes.
Okay. And how about the command center at Herndon? Did you have any kind of direct line to Herndon that day?
At a control position, no.
That would have been at John's position or someone else. Okay. Who, in addition to John, what other supervisory personnel were present that day?
The operations manager, I don't recall him specifically if he was in the Tracon at the time, but I know him to have been in the facility because once I was released in position, I had conversation with him.
And who is that?
Jaime Llana, Jaime Llana.
Okay.
And he's the operations manager, so he would be the next step above the operations supervisor.
And the OS was
John
Hendershot. Who does Jaime report to? Do you know? Is he the senior person in the facility?
He would report to the deputy manager, the assistant air traffic manager, who would report to the air traffic manager for the facility.
Who was the ATM that day?
I don't recall if Sherelle Carper was acting or if Stan McLean was still there.
Stan McLean?
Yes.
Or Sherelle?
Yes.
Woman's name?
Yes, S-H-E-R-E-L-L-E.
Carper? One of the two of them would have been the ATM, and who would the deputy have been?
If Sherelle was acting, the deputy position may have been filled by someone acting. There was a time when Stan had actually transferred to another facility, and they were doing some movement within our facility. But the manager at the time should have been either Stan or acting as Sherelle, and then Sherelle was the deputy if Stan was
okay.
there.
So the chain then would be McLean, Carper, Heidi, Lana, and then John Hendershot. How many positions were active that day in the trade con?
At that time?
Yeah.
I don't feel that I could make an accurate statement on that. We were transitioning from a departure, a heavy departure time, to a heavy arrival time. And in the transition, positions are being opened. I had just opened mine and closed.
It's a fluid situation. Typically in a half a dozen or less than that. At about 9:30 in the morning, typically, how many positions?
Perhaps six or seven active operating positions.
Okay. And we understand that in the trade cons, you don't have, as the unreached centers do, a D side or an assistant, a regular associate. That's one person per scope.
We have the capability of carrying an additional staff, an additional person at a scope for certain positions.
Was your position one of those?
No.
Okay. And you didn't have a radar associate or an assistant that day?
Correct.
Okay. What's P-56?
Can I tell you? No. Prohibited airspace that is not allowed to be transgressed.
Right, and the specific areas in the Washington, D.C. area.
Is P-56 on your scope? You're giving the countdown as Flight 77 is heading eastbound. Do you have a waypoint, or do you have a specific scope reference to that? Is that always fixed on your scope? Is that always fixed within the system?
Yeah.
And does it show up as an area, or does it show up as like a dot with the White House? I mean, you were all giving specific countdowns. I'm just trying to recreate roughly what you were looking at. Were you looking at a dot? Were you looking at the P-56 area?
It's an outline.
It's an outline of the P-56 area, and everyone knows what's in there.
Going back to your statement, you advised the Dulles TRACON OS, the operations supervisor, that's John Hendershot, of the target setting and rate of speed. You again adjusted the filter limits and provided updates to the OS as you adjusted the target tracking toward the White House. You heard the OS relaying the information via landline, and in the parentheses, you have ICSS. What's ICSS?
One of the acronyms that means he's able to either, via speakerphone, as we've discussed between National and Bell, access facilities, or to dial specific facilities that we don't have the speaker access to.
And then via the dedicated phone to the White House switchboard. Is that a dedicated phone, or was that Dulles? And it's to the switchboard, not to say a facility deeper within the White House, like the Secret Service Operations Center or someplace like that.
I don't have specific knowledge of
okay.
to whom it is specific.
And then you heard Washington National State over the landline to hold their traffic because the Pentagon had been hit.
Correct.
And that was your first awareness that something had hit the Pentagon, perhaps as plain as you had seen, perhaps not, but that the Pentagon itself had been hit. What happened then? Your statement sort of ends there, and I was just curious as to how that flowed through at that point.
It was very quickly after, if not immediately, that the determination was made that all aircraft were land. We proceeded to get down to business and really do as much as we could, as efficiently as we could, with a sharper edge than usual, to make sure that the last of these aircraft that we could bring to safety, we did.
Yeah. Did you have any awareness at all or understanding of the lighter plane that was also in trouble, the United 93?
Yes. Yeah.
What was your awareness of that plane?
We, in our naive United States Way had evacuated to the basement of the Tricon, not knowing what to do elsewise, and it was at that time that Mr. Lana, the operations manager, said they had been made aware that there was a fourth site that was at issue, and it was currently over Pittsburgh, and they had reason to believe it was headed toward Washington. So that, my awareness was after my time of
right,
release.
Right, I understand.
Our goal, after we had provided that very hasty, I don't want to bring it to a point of sounding sloppy, as we brought all the aircraft in that were within our control and most expeditiously helped everybody get to those airports near us, consolidated positions, and they actually had me relieved and a few other people relieved. We went down to a skeleton type crew, very much as we would if we evacuated a powerful bomb threat or anything like that. And so I was off position discussing, you know, and their discussion was, what do we want to take the employees off the facility now out of the general Dulles area?
Were the people that were involved that day, like yourself and your husband to deal with, to be, were you brought together in a group immediately after that at all to discuss the events or to capture firsthand an experience in some way?
Not as a group, no. Not all of us in the room at the same time discussing.
Right. And your statement was, you made your statement the next day, it looks like. There were no statements taken that day or group recordings or any other memorialization of the events that day?
Not from my knowledge. Not of myself. I have no knowledge of anyone making formal statements that day.
Did you make any personal notes or in the aftermath of the next few days or weeks write down your thoughts about what happened in the day?
No.
Were you interviewed or contacted by any other agencies within the following weeks and months as part of an investigation?
I was interviewed the day that I made this statement, and I recall it was the FBI at our facility that conducted the interview.
National Traffic Safety Board didn't interview you?
No, I've not talked to you.
And since the FBI talked to you and you did the 2020 interview, were the first people to chat with you?
No.
Who else?
I spoke with Todd Leventhal from the Office of Misinformation, he's the information officer for the Counter Misinformation. Something like that.
What department? a federal department?
Yeah, it is a federal department. And I came, I came with this it's something misinformation. I came to have discussion with I got his name, Todd Leventhal. I came to my discussion and contact with him through our air traffic manager, Mr. Cobanzo, in this facility.
Is that an FAA office?
I don't believe so. International affairs, I believe it is.
What kind of things did you talk about with that office? That's curious.
A book was published by a French author.
Yes.
Who takes a very ugly stab at the best National Enquirer approach.
And the Pentagon that was not hit by an aircraft.
Right.
Exactly. That one.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it was in response. Mr. Leventhal asked me to make a statement in response to that.
There's no question that you had on your scope a fast-moving primary target on the eastbound.
I agree.
And the you recognized something, and it took you a few seconds to translate that into, hey, we got a real threat there. Was that a matter of seconds or a minute at most?
Definitely less than a minute. It was a very quick translation in my mind that something was unusual. And then after that, an additional translation into this is a potential threat.
Did you ever ask yourself the question, how come me? How come I'm the first one to pick that up? How come someone from Washington Center or Indy Center didn't pick up this fast mover eastbound?
No,
Would you, to follow up on that, kind of as a similar question, in a modest way, I mean, would you describe your detection of Flight 77 as extraordinary, a skill set required to detect that, or was based on an average standard for an average controller? Would an average controller been able to see what you were seeing on your console? I mean, was it that clear that this was a fast-moving primary headed eastbound? I'm just trying to get a sense of if it was kind of for the layman, not, you know, looking at consoles always, was this a flashing thing that you couldn't miss, or did it take some unique qualified skill set to pick it out? And I know this is only you can't say specifically, but how do you feel about your detection of that?
Certainly, my choice to make adjustments to my altitude limit would be typical of my initial belief that this was someone in an ultra-high altitude stratum traveling across the Washington area, working with Washington Center on the way to London. And an aircraft in that high altitude stratum would move at that rate of speed. Mm-hmm. That's not unusual. It was not a glaring slap you in the face, this is unusual, grab your attention. As I mentioned, we were getting ready for an arrival time, so it's sometimes a bit of a transitional period. Folks are getting into the terminal, they're making their connections, they're getting back on the plane, and so there's a bit of time lapse in between the arrival and departure time. So I was actually not tasked with a lot at the moment. Not many aircraft on my frequency, the weather was very good, and so you have a relaxed opportunity working in non-busy position to monitor more, to be nosy, to see what everybody else is doing and see how you can help your fellow controllers to make the things go smoothly, more expeditiously. You can offer to help them out in coordination, adjusting routes, approving shortcuts, anything that you can do. That's just a controller's nature. We try to help each other all the time. So that somebody else didn't notice it, I would not find particularly odd.
Well, no, not whether or not someone else didn't notice it, but in terms of another individual, I think you've stated that it wasn't a slap you in the face recognition type thing, but just a factor, actually several factors. There was a lapse time, plus the way you had your console configured, it allowed you to detect that, not in the realm of should anybody else have seen it. I just was trying to get a characterization on what skill set was required for you to notice that fast-moving primary. Now, technically, you said that this is the period between arrivals and departures. Were you going from, was in that order, you were shifting to departures, or were you shifting to arrivals?
Shifting to arrivals.
Shifting to arrivals. So it was from departures to arrivals.
Correct.
And what time did that normally occur on an average day?
It was, timing was normal. Everything was normal as far as we had an arrival period at 7 o'clock, and then departure period prior to 9, and then we've got another arrival period that starts at 10:45 and then finishes up by 12:15. And when there's no weather in the area, you can merely set your watch by. It's very predictable.
Okay.
Anybody at the tower see that airplane coming?
At Dulles Farm, no. At Reagan,
we do Reagan, but we haven't found any evidence in the upstairs from you to pick it up.
That would have been an extreme distance to see, even from our tower. The Manassas Airport is 13, 14 miles away, and this guy was even further west than that.
Right.
And having been a tower controller at Dulles, to look out the window with your binoculars and see somebody 5 miles away is a good day. If it's nice and clear, you can see them. Depends on, are they face on to you? Are they on the side with their wings displayed?
Plus, he's still at altitude out here, too, a little bit.
Apparently he must have had some altitude when he came across there.
That was another question that I actually had on to my tongue was, Can you, in a kind of using, tapping into your professional expertise, give me an idea of this aircraft is decreasing in altitude, and so it's a primary that's fast moving and decreasing in altitude. How does that affect the complication of detection from someone? I mean, I know how you all have sectors, and various sectors would be configured to look in their area that they're responsible for. The fact that 77 is decreasing in altitude, moving at a high rate of speed, and not transponding, how does that complicate the detection of that? How would you assess that? Again, kind of just as a judgment statement, not a statement in fact.
The radar site that we utilized at Dulles was actually located at Dulles. Mm-hmm. So your return based on line of sight is going to be better 5 miles from the airport than 25 miles out toward the Blue Ridge Mountains. Terrain can be an obstruction. Because the radar is located right there, it is a very clear line of sight and a better radar presentation than if an aircraft were further away. The lower the altitude, once other obstructions start becoming a factor, the more questionable your radar return will be, which is what I suppose mm-hmm. happened as he made the maneuver, is his altitude must have been too low, or our radar interrogator was not getting enough information from the return that it was able to provide a display for me.
Can we back it up a little bit instead of talking about the very low altitude kind of final moments of it? Again, this is not statements in fact, but just going based on, we're trying to, you know, understand the system. If you could offer your professional commentary on, you know, when we're talking at higher altitudes than these low kind of final last moments, as it's heading eastbound, as it's still out, say 20, 30 miles, 40 miles out, it's decreasing in altitude. How does that affect a controller's ability to detect it as a primary? Do you follow my line of questioning there? It's basically traveling through multiple sectors at a fast rate of speed. So what impact does that have on a controller who maybe is responsible for his sector, his or her sector? Technically, is that an issue? Is that complicated or not complicated? Or would a qualified controller be able to see through that? We're just trying to get a sense of that.
I feel I'm being asked to evaluate something I'm not sure I can, because we don't have primary aircraft that fly out of flight levels, which is controlled, all controlled airspace,
right,
into approach control environments without a transponder.
Right.
In the event that we would have had an aircraft that perhaps had a failing transponder and didn't have a backup or was having an electrical problem, an emergency, something like that, we would be talking to them, we would know their altitude, and so it would not strike me as odd to say, yes, it's a great altitude return at 6,000 feet, 50 miles away, that I've never had an unidentified aircraft come into the area, like without equipment on board.
Your comments and your statement actually are helpful to us as well.
American Air 77 did have some altitude associated with altitude capability to read its altitude. There was a capability to do that. It existed at the Northeast Air Defense Sector, and they were getting a feed from the planes radar, which is an older radar and does not detect altitude on primary only. But the Gettysboro, New Jersey radar does. It did have the capability to detect altitude on primary only targets, but only readable to Northeast Air Defense Sector, not readable anywhere in FAA. We know from that data that at about 9:28, American Air 77 was to the west of Warrenton at an approximate altitude of 14,000 feet, with a margin of error of 3,000 feet on that.
Say that again,
14,000 feet. Possibly 17, possibly right on the...
Or 11.
The margin of error is 3,000 feet on the military's ability to read altitude on that.
Does that fact in and of itself tell you anything?
This is the first that I'm aware of.
That's the first you're aware of any altitudinal data that we have in 77. Okay. And the reason, just to give you a little bit of background, we have the Joint Surveillance System radar reduction files from the Air Force and from the National Traffic Safety Board. And it looked to us, and going back through the radar, that there was a possible near collision with American 77 and an airplane southwestbound, western Washington. Do you recall anybody mentioning a control problem?
No.
Okay. Do you recall an aircraft, and I'm going to show you this. This is the track with 77 coming in. The green track is, I'm from the military, it's the old NECAP, National Airborne Command Post. It's a 7-4 heavy off of Andrews. And it's vectored to the south and then back to the north. And its call sign was either Word 31 or Sword 31. A, do you recall that aircraft coming westbound? And B, why would it have been vectored the way it was vectored?
I do not recall Sword 31. Sword 31 would have been a track target with an identifying data block associated
right.
with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it was squawking. It was Mode 3, Mode 2.
When you have a track target and you're working a specific position, you filter through, consciously and subconsciously, you filter through what you need to see and pay attention to and know and digest. So for me to have not been watching Sword 31 would have been the exception if I
right.
had
and
watched
it. And we understand you weren't. I'm just trying to figure out why it was vectored south and then back north again.
It is procedure between aircraft departing DCA and Andrews to be vectored to the south of Dulles. Sometimes they come further up the river and then on the east side of Dulles bend south down and back out.
Right.
The reason for that is because we are handing off aircraft, the national rivals that you heard mentioned,
right.
over Dulles at 8,000 feet. So in order to gain enough altitude to do the climbing of the departure and the descending of the inbound, they can't be head-on.
Right.
So while it would have been more expeditious for Sword to go direct to his next point, he would have been face-on potentially with a rival aircraft. And our letter of agreement would have reflected that at the time.
What I hear you saying is what I'm seeing here would be a routine air traffic control procedure to move that traffic east to west.
For Sword 31?
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the traffic pattern that day was landing to the north. So would that also have an impact?
The Dulles operation?
Yeah, I think the Dulles North South River was landing south to north that day.
Yes, we were landing north, however, that would make no impact on how the bird would have climbed out.
Yeah. So irrespective of which runway was being used, this would be the normal pattern to get this airplane to the west.
Or a similar pattern.
Or similar, okay.
Yes.
We suspected that, but I needed someone to tell me that this was routine, not abnormal. And I think the clear reason that I would ask that is the timeshare are well 6 or 7 minutes earlier than you came up on the line with the primary. So. Okay, thank you. Do you recall at all a discussion about the C-130 that came up over 06? Did you get involved in all of this control?
I cannot independently pull that. Gopher is familiar to me. But I don't know if it's in direct correlation to this.
It is.
Okay. You might have to lead me here a little bit because I'm not taking...
I'm just asking you on the margin because it's actually being controlled by the National... Reagan Tower has got Gopher 06. I don't think you guys ever get involved. It's headed to you, but they vectored 06 to follow 77.
Yes, I recall that. I recall awareness that they had a C-130 in their control that they were working with. I never worked Gopher or had any reason to talk with him.
And I didn't think you did, but I just had to ask you that question because that also one of the things we initially asked ourselves is what military aircraft were in the sky that day. Clearly, this is the Pentagon was hit long before the Langley, well, not long before, but minutes before the Langley fighters got to the Washington area. Patrol, by the way, is one of the reasons I was asking about Langley and Norfolk earlier. Our understanding of the military aircraft that were in the air that day in the area were the 7-4 Heavy off of Andrews, Cobra 6, the C-130. There were two Air Force, current Air Force executive jets at altitude trending from probably off of Dover going from northeast to southwest, Bobcat 14 and Bobcat 17. And I just ask you if those two call signs ring a bell at all.
Yeah.
Okay. And there was probably a Marine Corps helicopter that lifted off the Pentagon at about 9:30 or so in the approximate time that you spotted the inbound blip. And it doesn't look like it would have gotten your airspace, but the question simply is, did you have any awareness of a Marine Corps helicopter being airborne at the time the American 77 hit the Pentagon?
For sure, no. I cannot say I had or did not have awareness. I don't recall.
When did you ultimately that day become aware that it was NC-77 at the Pentagon? And I guess the following question would be, did you ever really know that the target you picked up was 77 on that day?
I learned that the aircraft, that it was an aircraft and it was an air carrier, I believe, via the media. And I did not know it was the specific plane that I had worked outbound until I returned the next day to the facility to make a statement. I didn't make the correlation that I worked this guy out and in until they asked me to sit down and make two statements, and I said, why two? And they said, well, you worked them out as well as watching them in.
Yeah. Is it in the course of your business at Dulles that day that you would have had opportunity or reason or a means of contacting either American Airlines or United Airlines?
As a controller, the only opportunity on position that we would have would be to ask for a company aircraft to relay to its company for the other aircraft the event of a lost communication. Somebody who's flying about on the wrong frequency trying to get a hold of them, that would be one avenue we would try.
That in fact is the avenue that Boston Center used and New York Center used to try and contact American Airlines, which was the first one. That you didn't have a hotline or a button you push or a means of contacting company here.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't have any more questions.
Daniel, we appreciate very much you going back over the events of that day with us. And most assuredly, we probably haven't asked you everything we should have. Is there anything that if you were sitting here, you would ask yourself that we haven't asked you? Always a tough question.
Yeah. I would ask me a little bit about my training history.
Yes, please.
As far as hijacked aircraft.
Yes. And we have typically done that, and we're going to get around that with you. So we covered our key on that, Kim.
Now that she brought it up.
Yes.
Thank you for doing so.
Tell us.
Okay. From my first days as an air traffic controller, nearly 17 years ago now. We are trained that hijackers are treated with the utmost of care and delicacy, and you part the Red Sea to make way for them, their request. You abide by everything. You do everything that you can to be an enabler to get them to their goals so that it can be resolved in a peaceful manner. And for 17 years, that was always my opinion of hijacking, and should be the opinion of every other FAA air traffic controller and military controllers training on hijacking up to this point, up to the point of a terrorist attack. because that's just what happened. They wanted to take the plane, go get their friends in Cuba, and fly off somewhere else. There were no issues within CONUS. There just weren't. Having been a controller on Guam in an international arena, that's the same training. We're not Israel. We don't expect these sorts of things. Were we ignorant? Obviously. We didn't think of the evil intention, the possibility of such evil within our own airspace system. This is a wonderful airspace system that we protect and we mother every day as controllers. We watch out for them. We're the calm in their emergency. Their plane is shutting down and we're talking to them as you would talk to your child to encourage them and direct them. So it has to be thought of and considered so highly that all air traffic controllers are not thinking. None of us are thinking that plane is bent on destruction and life loss.
Well, what is the nature of your annual training? How often were you trained on hijackings or exercises?
I recall the hijacking training as an annual refresher requirement, and it may be semi-annually. I wouldn't say it's annually, and it's always been required from my first days at Washington Center through current. It's changed. But
did that training ever include scenarios where the airplane was hijacked to be used as a weapon, where the pilot was not in control of the aircraft itself?
There was never a situation where we considered it being used as a weapon. We would simulate whenever time and personnel permitted. We would have simulation in our labs where you can drum up an airplane and make him fly and change his squawk, and it doesn't affect the flying public at all. It's a computer-generated situation. And what would you do? Maybe one person on the crew will be directing the plane and the rest are huddled around, and then you talk about it. What would you do? What could you do? What would be some options if this happens, if this happens? Sometimes it's a written refresher, but it's always with the intent, okay, you want to change your destination? We can do that. You need to stop here for fuel? Okay, we'll relay that to the supervisor who will forward it to the airport and forward it to the law enforcement. And it was just always, supervisor, we've got, a swapper here. And
yeah, for 17 years, that's been the procedure. You have hijacked and you notify your supervisor.
Always, always. That's just how it's always been. Yeah. Never as a weapon.
That's a training change.
Yes.
How so?
We have different indications for potential hijacking now, specifically aircraft that are arriving to Washington National. We have a higher rate of sensitivity to pilots or pilots' requests that may have not been too abnormal before, maybe different, but not to the point of alerting fighter aircraft. We have special access provided to the DC area only by code word. And if they don't have the code word, they don't go to National. And there's no argument. It's just period. No compromise. Certainly, a supervisor alert is still
right.
Primary in the list.
Is there anything that needs to be changed that hasn't changed? Is there any recommendations you would ask our commissioners to entertain? Either at the highest level or some level in between?
I would applaud the things that are being put in place as far as fighter activity over the Washington area.
The caps.
The changes as far as the immediate interaction between a representative at our facility and the North American Defense System is very good. And the changes that I've seen have been, I think, the best we can do You cannot search every inch of a person's suitcase every single time. If they want to do it, they'll do it again. And it has nothing to do with air traffic control. It has to do with the cooperative motivation of these people who, the four of us, I'll bring a piece of a gun, you bring a piece of a gun, you bring a piece, you bring a piece, and between the four of us, you know, we'll either kill a lot of people or we'll take the plane down. But air traffic control really can't help that.
What else didn't I ask you? You did pretty good on that. Did you meet with those cards? We'll give you a card if you do think of something that we haven't chatted with you about, or we really do need to know. You've helped us immensely in understanding how things went that day. We appreciate very much your replaying the events of that day for us. Kevin, anything else?
No, thanks a lot for your time.
We're concluding the interview with Daniel O'Brien Howell on the 22nd of December.